Good evening, listeners. Welcome to Hitler's Table Talk tonight. This is episode 35 on November 6, 2014. I'm Carolyn Yeager, and Ray Goodwin, my co-host, will be along anytime now. I do miss being able to chat with him before the show. He's not always on his Skype now, since he doesn't use the Skype. So we have to get on and get right down to business. But we've got some good material tonight, a large part of which, but certainly not all, deals with Adolf Hitler's faithful concern for bringing great and uplifting art and music to be made available to all the German people throughout the Reich. And I'll just say, while I'm waiting for his call and watching it, that, boy, we've been having a lot of rain here. We've got drenched, and it's really great. It's wonderful, really, to get this to store up all this water underground. But at the same time, I'm not used to cloudy, and it's even a little bit cold now, weather and no sun. I've been living in almost always sunny climes for so many years now. Here he is. That I get sort of depressed if I have 2 days without the sun. And then I go into the third one, I'm like, wow, I feel like this. And I think it's the low pressure, too, which kind of is a downer on your mood. What about you, Ray? Have you been having all the rain, too?
Well, light to medium. Not in a lot of accumulation. 7/10 of an inch yesterday and probably that much today. It's been steady and light, but it's very nice to see.
Well, we had this big, huge thing move across here, and It was steady, and it wasn't like a big thunderstorm or anything at all, but it came down
right.
Pretty good, and I'm sure we got a number of inches, quite a few inches already. I have to find out from my neighbor, but you know, I miss the sun. I'm really missing it, and I find that it affects my mood terrible, you know. I think
sure.
That's what it is. Yeah.
Right. This is two days in a row of dark and dreary, if you will. But
three and a half for me, and I think it's also, as I was already said, I think it's also the pressure system. You know, we're used to high pressure, and when it's low pressure, it's a different kind of a feeling. But I used to tolerate it quite well and even liked it. But I think I've lost my ability, my resistance for that. Well, do you have any introductory remarks, Ray, before you start with tonight's material?
Yeah, you know, this particular section that we'll be covering tonight is, more proof that this man was extremely well-rounded. And tonight is a discussion of a lot of high culture items, interesting section on assassination attempts on him, and a bit of talk about that. But you know, the real thing here is, you know, he talks about diet once again and building, architecture, things like this. So just more demonstration of how well-rounded his knowledge was.
Yes, yeah. I think the art and architecture kind of dominates tonight. He talks a lot about painting and art museums and so on. But there's a lot of different things, and very, very, very good. And he starts out talking about General Giraud. So we'll let you start that if you're ready.
All right. Okay. Reich Chancellery, 25th of April, 1942, midday. The escape of General Giraud, what France really feels towards us. We will retain strong points in France, meat and the vegetarian diet, importance of raw food. The Fuhrer replies to a question by Minister Frick regarding the recent escape of General Giraud. We must do everything possible to recapture this man. As far as I know, he is a general of great ability and energy, who might well join the opposition forces of de Gaulle and even take command of them. History shows again and again that it is not only the younger men in their early 30s who are capable of brilliant exploits. some have shown even earlier in life, as for example Napoleon and Alexander, who was but 20 years of age, but that very often it is in their 60s and even their 70s that many men accomplish their greatest achievements. For my part, I see in the escape of this general, to whom every possible facility had been granted to alleviate the burden of captivity, a significant pointer to the real attitude of the French towards us. We must therefore keep a very cool head in our dealings with them, both now during the armistice period and later when the peace treaty is formulated, and we must bear in mind all historical precedents and take decisions in which sentiment plays no part. We must not be content with the control of the Atlantic islands. If we are to ensure the hegemony of the continent, we must also retain strong points on what was formerly the French Atlantic coast. We must further not forget that the old Kingdom of Burgundy played a prominent role in German history, and that it is from time immemorial German soil, which the French grabbed at the time of our weakness. Dr. Goebbels asked whether a pound of potatoes had the same nutritive value as a pound of meat. The Fuhrer replied.
Before we go into here, what he has to say about that, what did you, I didn't actually go and study up on this general. What was so special about him?
No.
Did you?
He just was highly regarded, is all I know, by the military command as a leader. Yeah, they had they must have felt pretty highly about him and his ability to get kind of worked up about his escape.
Yeah, I was going to say, it must have been a real event, and well, I really missed the boat there. I did look into quite a number of things that we're going to cover tonight, but for some reason that just seemed to be sort of nothing to me, but it might have been pretty important because a general escaping like that, yeah, how did he escape anyway? Well, it's probably a very interesting story. Well, okay, let that go. Go ahead.
You know, the thing about it was, too, they had him, he was not in a really what you would call a lockdown or severe facility either. He apparently, was kept in a much more light place, as it says to whom every possible facility had been granted to alleviate the burden of captivity.
The officer, the better they treat them, and they treat all officers. You don't even have to be a general. And the Germans were better about that. Well, the others did pretty well in the beginning, maybe not so well as towards the end, but and after the war certainly. But that was traditional, and this guy wouldn't have been suffering. But you're supposed to, you're supposed to try to escape if you're an officer. You're not supposed to just sit there and let yourself be in captivity. Yep. So anyway.
True. Okay, we'll move on.
Okay, so Dr. Goebbels asks him, I think this is a riot. He comes out and says, well, mein Führer, do you think a pound of potatoes has the same nutritive value as a pound of meat? So what does Adolf come up with for that?
The Führer replied, as far as we know, the food of the soldiers of ancient Rome consisted principally of fruit and cereals. The Roman soldier had a horror of meat, and meat apparently was included in the normal rations only when the difficulty of obtaining other supplies made it inevitable. From numerous pictures and sculptures, it seems that the Romans had magnificent teeth, and this seems to contradict the contention that only carnivorous animals have good teeth. The intervening centuries do not appear to have caused any changes. Travelers in Italy have noticed that the masses still feed on the same things and that they still have excellent teeth. One has only to keep one's eyes open to notice what an extraordinary antipathy young children have to meat. It is also an interesting fact that among the Negroes, the children of those tribes which are primarily vegetarian develop more harmoniously than those of the tribes in which it is customary for the mother to feed her infant up to the age of 4 or 5. As regards animals, The dog, which is carnivorous, cannot compare in performance with the horse, which is vegetarian. In the same way, the lion shows signs of fatigue after covering 2 or 3 kilometers, while the camel marches for 6 or 7 days before even his tongue begins to hang out. Speaking generally, the experts do not take facts sufficiently into consideration. It has been proved that a vegetarian diet, and particularly a diet of potato peelings and raw potatoes, will cure beriberi within a week. Those who adopt a vegetarian diet must remember that it is in their raw state that vegetables have their greatest nutritive value. The fly feeds on fresh leaves. The frog swallows the fly as it is. The stork eats the living frog. Nature thus teaches us that a rational diet should be based on eating things in their raw state. Science has proved, too, that cooking destroys the vitamins, which are the most valuable part of our food. It has not yet been established beyond doubt whether cooking destroys merely certain chemical particles or whether it also destroys the essential fermentive juices. Our children today are much healthier than those of the Imperial and Weimar Republic periods because mothers now realize that they contribute far more to the health of their children if they give them raw vegetables and roots to chew than if they give them boiled milk. So.
Oh, my gosh. I think he would have done better if he stayed away from talking about diet so much. Some of it's all right, but, I question, were they realizing that they needed to give their children raw vegetables to chew rather than boiled milk? I think they were still giving them boiled milk. And Germans were known to drink warm milk, so it had to be heated up a little bit or something, and Austrians especially, and I don't know how many other peoples. But, this thing about raw potatoes curing beriberi, well, beriberi is a thiamine deficiency, and it's a lack of the thiamine pyrophosphate, the active form of vitamin B1. And the body doesn't produce thiamine, so, you have to constantly be taking it in. It can only store up to 30 milligrams in tissue. And thiamine is most available in, most prevalent in whole grains, and meat, fish, poultry, and eggs, then milk, and then veggies, and potatoes are mentioned. You know, all the vitamins are in the majority of the vitamins in vegetables are right under the skin. They're so close to the skin that they're part of the skin, And if
right.
you peel potatoes, you'll destroy it. You'll peel it away.
Certainly.
So,
lose some nutritive value for sure.
Oh, most of it. So, So he says, well, okay, if people eat a diet of potato peelings, well, how much potato peelings would you have to eat? And he says raw potatoes so that you don't kill it by cooking. So how much raw potatoes can you eat? I mean, raw potatoes are not too good. I don't think they're too good for you either. When it comes to raw vegetables, that's not quite the same. I'm sure Goebbels was chuckling or something. And nobody was taking the Fuhrer seriously when he's talking about this because they weren't interested in becoming vegetarians. And I hate to say that. He thought that he did better on that. He thought that it was better for him, so he was looking for all these reasons why it was better. But we find today that it really is not better for us. So.
Yeah.
Anyway, I thought he kind of went far-fetched there. In order to defend himself and defend his word. Well.
Okay, the Reich Chancellery, 26th April 1942, midday, Artists and Politics. While lunching hurriedly at the Chancellery before attending a session of the Reichstag, Dr. Goebbels told the Fuhrer of some of his experiences with Artists in Politics. He said that recently he had had to protest again to Jennings about making remarks hostile to the regime. It was with reluctance that Jennings eventually admitted that, in his love of animated conversation, he may have said things which could be misconstrued and enlarged upon to the detriment of the prestige of the state. The Fuhrer replied, "I have long realized that actors and artists often have such fantastic ideas that one is compelled from time to time to shake an admonitory finger at them and bring them back to earth." And I think that was interesting. Emil Jannings was a pretty popular actor at that time, and he appeared in some films made here as well. But I'm sure that's who he's talking about. And so he might have made some critical remarks, you know, and it's like Hitler says. Well, you know, even today actors speak out politically on occasion. They know they run a risk, particularly today, if an actor speaks out towards maybe our side of viewpoint of politics or history. They know better than to do that because all of a sudden the well runs dry. There's no more parts for them and nobody hires them. But, you know, back then, nothing different. They're a person, too, and they would occasionally voice their opinion. And Jannings apparently said some things which irritated some people, and he just brought it to Hitler's attention, asking him, "What do you think about it?" And
Hitler has said before that he said the same kind of a thing elsewhere,
yes,
where he was right. Saying, well, we, you know, he loves the actors and the artists and so on, and loves being in their company, but he realizes that they, he kind of excuses them. He doesn't get angry
yes.
at them when they
no.
say things that are wrong, because nobody, I guess he thinks nobody takes them seriously anyway. If someone in his government would say those things, he would be upset, but he kind
yeah.
of excused his artist friends, not just the actors or actresses, but often other
right.
artists, you know.
I think that speaks well for him, really, because
right.
He's not adamant, and you know, I think he believes in the right of people, even if they differ, to have their say, as long as they keep it within bounds. And you know, from whatever category they come from, like you say here, actors and artists, things like this, oh, well, okay, you know, he knows that their knowledge of government, history, and politics is very, very limited. And so when they say something, it doesn't burn like an iron to him. And so that's why I think he kind of just, okay, let them have their say, brush them off, move on. And I think that's a good attitude to take.
Mm-hmm. Well, you know, I have a timeline here for the 26th and 27th, since
okay.
we don't have anything on the 27th. So I will give that the, you know, April 26th, 1942, they say Hitler assumes a kind of supreme authority over Germany. Well, what I found was he made a very important speech to the Reichstag, and I didn't find him saying he was taking any particular authority. I thought maybe it was when he became commander, supreme commander of the armed forces, and took that on for himself. But that was in 1938 when there was this kind of scandal with Bloomberg, who was the commander in chief, and he when after that thing. Bloomberg married a 26-year-old typist. He had been there with Hitler for a long time, and he was very loyal, but he started to, I don't know, some people didn't like him. Goebbels was one of them. Goebbels and Goering didn't, no, Goering and Himmler didn't like him, and then his wife died, and he married a 26-year-old typist with a rather unsavory, supposedly criminal record, but it was nothing serious, but they said that she had been a prostitute, but that turned out to be not true. Maybe her mother was or something like that. I don't know. I got a little confused reading about it. But he wouldn't give her up. Hitler told him he had to let go of this woman and divorce her, you know, annul the marriage or something. He wouldn't do it. And well, I think by then their things were a little bit different. He wasn't really refusing. I don't know. I don't have it all written down here. But scoring in Himmler managed to force him out, and at that was the time then that Hitler made himself the supreme commander, and he changed the Department of War, or whatever it was, to the OKW, the Oberkommando of the Wehrmacht, and he became the head of that. That was in 1938. So in 1942, he gave a really important speech to the Reichstag, and I think that's what they're talking about, that they think that he, because they say a kind of supreme authority over Germany, you know, they're always accusing him of something or other, being a dictator. So then on the 27th, Rostock, which we talked about before, that city way up north on the Baltic coast, is bombed for the fourth night in a row. And that's and then a national plebiscite on the 27th was held in Canada on the issue of conscription. The French Canadians are the main, though not the only, objectors of the draft. So some people didn't want a draft. They were trying to set up a draft, and the French Canadians were the main ones who objected to it. That's the timeline.
Okay, good. Berlin, 28th April 1942, at dinner. The artistic patrimony of towns, policy as regards works of art, the claims of Vienna, Budapest and Linz, fighting the false science of the church, plans for a new Linz, repay the Hungarians in their own coin. Gauleiter Forster turned the conversation to the question of works of art, which were the property of Danzig, but which were actually at the moment in Krakow, and asked whether these should now be returned to Danzig. The Führer replied, "I must say that in principle I'm against the idea. If we once start that sort of thing, we shall never end. We should spend all our time examining claims. Every town in the place will claim some picture or other, and they will all amuse themselves by trying to prove some connection between themselves and some work of art. After the French campaign and the occupation of Serbia and the Russian territories, Liebel, the mayor of Nuremberg, approached me and requested the return to Nuremberg of all the works of art to which he could possibly stake a claim. If one granted all these requests, the museums in which the works in question now are would become valueless. Not only that, but many pictures would find themselves divorced from the environment in which the artist had wished to place them, and would thus lose significance. When I went to see the works of art which had belonged to collections sequestrated from the Jews in Vienna, I insisted that they should remain in Vienna because their places were earmarked for them in museums of that city. Contrary to the suggestions made to me, I even insisted that certain other works should be reassembled in places where they would form the nucleus of new collections. For example, the works of Franz Hals to Linz and the Tyrolese landscapes to Innsbruck. Although my decision was not to the liking of my dear Viennese, I was all the more insistent because I knew that in the course of the five centuries of their reign, the Habsburgs had collected in the cellars and storerooms of Vienna enough works of art to fill three new museums. Of Gobelin tapestry alone, there are in the Viennese storerooms no less than 3,000 examples, all worked entirely by hand, and all equally magnificent, which the public have never seen. I know my Viennese inside out. The moment we start to consider a Rembrandt or two taken from the Jews, they will at once start to try, in that gentle, naive way of theirs, to persuade me to leave all the works of great masters in Vienna, arguing that the works of lesser painters will be quite good enough to ensure the happiness of the museums of Linz or Innsbruck. And what a fuss they made when I announced my decision that any masterpieces which were not required to fill an actual void in the Vienna museums were to be distributed among the museums of the other Alpine and Danubian provinces. This tapestry storeroom systems and such as this. I think part of what he's talking about there, well, you know, you would if it was painted on the side of a long building, you would call it a mural, but it's much smaller than that. But it's a long work of art that tells a story. A lot of the tapestries that were mentioned in English art way back a long time ago. And that word kind of caught my eye when I read that. And they're very important to history as well as to art. And I thought it was significant that he mentioned that the public have never seen those, that they've been stored in cellars and storerooms for, you know, 400 or 500 years. So anyway, I just want to take note of that.
Yeah, well, tapestries are legitimate works of art. Considered so, and they're highly prized by the museums that have them. And if he's right, you know, which I suppose he is, he says that they had all of them. They were hoarding, you know, that's what he's been talking about that all along, how Vienna wanted to have all the art, all the good stuff, everything, you know. You know, right there in Vienna, and that's how they thought. And he said that the Habsburgs prided themselves on Vienna, and they went along, they did that, you know, and so they had everything. They couldn't even show it all, you know, they had it in their storerooms. And he's starting out here, which he continues more later, to talk about how he wants to distribute the best art, some of it, everywhere around in the Reich, and not just have it all in the capital cities, mainly in Berlin and Vienna, which have always had most of everything, you know, the best of everything.
He's doing a lot of common sense thinking here, Carolyn, when he says things like this, because my goodness, I mean, how magnificent a work of art, you know, how valuable is it if nobody ever gets to view it? And all of this stuff stored for 400, 500 years, and they can brag about we have these wonderful works of art. Well, hey, if nobody ever sees it, so what? And what Hitler is talking about is building new museums and putting this stuff on view, and that's what gives it its value.
Common sense is the same word I came up with for tonight's, a lot of material in tonight's program, Ray, that he's just using common sense. And in so many, he wouldn't even have to spend any time thinking about it. The situation would come up and common sense would tell him almost immediately how to handle it and what needed to be done. That's why some of this, you know, I saw it that way. And so often we don't value what anybody would almost think the same way about unless they're weird, you know. I mean, just everybody understands, well, sure, that's the right thing to do. But now he talks about, there's two references here to Jewish artwork and our artwork belonging to Jews. And he says, well, we had... collection sequestered from the Jews in Vienna, and I'm not sequestered, sequestrated. And sequestrated is to take legal possession of something until a debt has been paid or other claims have been met. So they used that term. They were thinking in terms of the what the Jews had taken and what they owed back, and they were taking, as we mentioned, and you put it in those words once before, they were just taking it back. You know, what really was taken wrongly taken by the Jews. So this is what they were thinking when they came upon these collections, which I guess these Jewish families were broken up, or they fled, they did this or that or whatever. And so then they had this, you know, they took the collections, but they were earmarked for belonging to the German people and definitely not taking it for their own. And then again, down below, he said, if a Rembrandt or two taken from the Jews, boy, that doesn't sound very good, but I don't know how many Rembrandts they got. He's just using that phrase, but, you know, he's just saying that They want to keep them all. The Rembrandt would be the very best, so they would want to keep that in Vienna, you know, these museums and so on. Whereas he wants to spread things around. That's the same thing.
Yeah, but, you know, Jews told him, oh, let the works of lesser value and lesser known artists fill in at Linz and Munich or Innsbruck or wherever, you know. Let's keep the good stuff here.
Right.
So.
That's exactly right. Gosh, you know, I was amazed when I went through the great art museum in Vienna, what was in there. Oh, my gosh. You know, it's just, it just knocks you over. I mean, the most famous things, and they've got so much. And the same in Berlin, you know. And so, you know, you can certainly get some other places because there are a lot of wonderful cities in Germany, in any place, you know, where major cities that have museums, and they should have some of these top works too. Okay, well, that's what I wanted to say there.
Okay, all righty, we'll move on here with, the Führer turns to Speer. Budapest is by far the most beautiful city on the Danube, but I'm determined to make of Linz a German town on the Danube which surpasses it, and by so doing to prove that the artistic sense of the Germans is superior to that of the Magyars. Not only shall I have the bank of the river built up in a magnificent fashion, but also I intend to build a number of dwelling houses which will be models of their kind. On the banks of the Danube there will be a great hotel reserved for the Strength Through Joy organization, municipal buildings designed by Professor Giesler, a party house designed by the architect Fick, a building for Army headquarters, an Olympic stadium, and many other things. As regard bridges, I intend, in contradistinction to Budapest, to have one suspension bridge at Linz. On the opposite bank, I shall construct, as a counter to the pseudoscience of the Catholic Church, an observatory in which will be represented the three great cosmological conceptions of history, those of Ptolemy, of Copernicus, and of Horbiger. The cupola of this edifice will contain a planetarium which will not only satisfy the thirst for knowledge of the visitors, but will also be available for purposes of scientific research. The interior decoration will be inspired largely by the ideas of Professor Troost. In this connection, there was a rather amusing little contretemps. I had amused myself by roughing out some designs for this interior decoration, using for the purpose the red, blue, and green pencils I have in my office, and by mistake, I sent this very sketch to Frau Troost instead of the birthday card I'd done for her. As regards the party house and the provincial parliament, Reichsleiter Bormann made a handsome offer which delighted me. As soon as he heard that the plans had been completed, he volunteered to provide the money for the projects. As the party treasurer has already undertaken to defray these expenses, I did not feel justified in accepting Bormann's offer, but I am nonetheless grateful to him. 10 years after the end of the war, Linz must have become the new metropolis of the Danube. I become daily more enthusiastic about this beautifying of Linz, and I think it is the reaction of the artistic sense in me. This city possesses something which no architecture, however magnificent, could give her, a unique natural situation. In spite of the bonds of affection which tie me to Linz, I can honestly say that it is its wonderful position which alone impels me to carry out the project. The Viennese would be quite wrong to worry that this might prove harmful to their monopoly or to the cultural interests of the Alpine and Danubian provinces. Far be it from me to lessen the importance of Vienna, so long as she remains on a sound and solid foundation. But when one thinks of the truly unique position of Linz, it is impossible, simply out of consideration for the feelings of the Viennese, to give up the idea of making Linz the metropolis of the Danube. It would be a crime. Further, if only to infuriate the Hungarians, everything must be done to embellish and to add to the beauties of Vienna itself. We shall only be repaying the Hungarians in their own coin once the war is over for having everywhere and so promptly taken advantage of circumstances and pulled their chestnuts out of the fire.
What is he referring to there? This is 1942. I couldn't figure it out. I didn't spend much time, but did you?
You know,
no, Ray, don't disappoint
me. I pondered over that, and I didn't know if he was referencing World War One things or political movements for the past year or two in Hungary, where they were more guarded in what they did, you know, as far as offering a helping hand to Germany or anything like that. I thought.
Well, were they? Were they holding back? That would be it if that was the case.
Yeah, and I feel like they must have been to an extent. And so that's, to me, that's what he made reference to, unless he was talking about maybe World War One when
I can't imagine that. That's too far back. Yeah, yeah. And their own coin, they're going to, for everywhere and so promptly, having taken advantage of circumstances and pulled their chestnuts out of the fire. Well, we know that they all turned away at the end, but not by 1942. So, anyway, that's what he's saying there. He's a little bit of playing a competitive game there with Budapest and on the Danube. But what I thought was really interesting here was, because it says he's, Albert Speer is there, and he actually turns and talks to Speer and tells about this architectural situation and talking about the city of Linz. And the fact is that Speer, at this time, he was his main big architect, and there was some feud going on between Speer and Giesler. And Giesler was there. He mentions Giesler.
Yes.
Was Giesler there in the beginning, or have we not come to the one yet where Giesler is present? Well, anyway, Hermann Giesler is another architect. What was happening was that, well, Speer was doing the very thing that Hitler was just talking about the art museums. He was in charge of Berlin and all the designing in Berlin, and he's head of the Bau construction office and of all Berlin, and so he had a lot of power, and he started hogging all the materials and building materials, and Giesler wasn't able to get them for his jobs down in Munich, and then Hitler put Giesler in charge of designing Linz, and this was kind of, and it seems to me that Hitler here is kind of chatting about this in a way to kind of tell Speer, in a way, that this is what's going on, and he just has to accept it, and it's okay, and he doesn't want to have any flack about it or any disagreement about it. And then he mentions he mentions Professor Giesler is designing the great hotel that he's going to have there, and then Fick is designing the army headquarters, and it's going to be an Olympic stadium, and these are both architects down in the Munich area that he's always worked with. Then he mentions Troost, Frau Troost, whose husband was the main party architect until he died, and Hitler thought a whole lot of him, and she was not an architect. She was more of an interior designer, but she took on quite a big role in the party, and so he mentions her. And to me, because Bormann was in charge of handling this feud between because they both went to Bormann, because they didn't want to go to Hitler and bother him, you know. Especially Giesler wouldn't do that. He wouldn't go directly to Hitler and complain. So he was complaining to Bormann, and Bormann was the one who was supposed to go to Hitler, which he did, and then he passed on what Hitler wanted or whatever. But Bormann was trying to handle it a lot. And so I think that Hitler was doing this without ever having talked directly to Speer about this feud. He didn't want to upset anybody. You know, he didn't want to upset Speer. He really liked Speer, but Speer had this way of wanting to run everything himself, and then he couldn't do it anyway. It was too much. So, but I found that for this reason very interesting, and it fits in with what I have on my at my website under the Einander Hitler articles, and it's the last one, The Battle of the Architects, if anybody is interested in going and taking a look at that. But so all this stuff is going on, you know, in the background that we don't really, don't always know why he's saying what he's saying.
Right.
In his talks.
Now, I feel like your copy of what you're looking at and reading there is probably like my book, or you would have probably said something to me. Now, we read the Reichschancellery the 26th of April, 1942, midday. Then the next one, which we just finished, was Berlin, the 28th of April, 1942, at dinner. We finished that, and this is the first time it's happened in the book for me. It goes back to April 27th between those 2 days, and I was figuring this page may have been just out of order at the printer, although it's still numerically on the incidents. It's 201 in my book. But he goes...
I made it the 29th, but I think it was messed up, and I just guessed at it as the 29th. I don't know. But I've got it as the 29th here, 201.
Yeah, you know, well, then maybe. But my book says the 27th, and he does mention Giesler being present at that one. And it actually should have come before that one right there on the 28th. And because the one after it does say the 30th. So maybe maybe either my book is wrong and it should be the 29th.
Well, I don't know. Yeah, because this previous one on the 28th, he's in Berlin and Speer is there. Well, that fits because Speer was in charge of Berlin. And in the 29th, he's in Munich, or the 27th, one or the other. And Giesler is there, and another man from Bavaria, Minister Esser. I checked into him, and he was he's an interesting deputy, longtime party member, and. Had a lot of jobs, and he was from Bavaria, too.
Uh-huh.
So that's the place is right, but the date could be either the 27th or the 29th, couldn't it?
Yeah.
So,
okay. Well, my book here says Munich, the 27th of April, 1942, midday.
But they've got it after the other one, which is...
Yes.
Kind of wrong. So either they've made a mistake in where they put it, or it is a typo for the date.
Yeah. Okay.
Anyway, there's a timeline here. It's sort of important. It's on the 29th. The Baedeker raids continue, focused on Norwich and York. Well, we talked about that last week, and maybe the week before too, and the. Those were the German raids on England in retaliation, supposedly, for the bombings, the bad nighttime bombings that the RAF was doing. And the Japanese cut the Burma Road with the capture of Lashio, so they're not giving up easily there. And Adolf Hitler summons Benito Mussolini and Galeazzo Ciano, that was his son-in-law, who was, you know, he... made a part of the government, to a summit conference in Salzburg. And now, here's the Wikipedia way of saying this. Like most Hitlerian conferences, this one is actually a thinly disguised attempt to harangue the invitees into compliance with the Führer's will. In this case, the Italians are to commit more troops to the Eastern Front. Hitler is successful, and Mussolini agrees to send an additional 7 divisions, as well as the 2 already promised. These unfortunate troops will be formed into the 8th Italian Army and attached to von Bock's, later von Weick's, Army Group B. Well, you know, whenever Hitler had these conferences, and he absolutely attempted to convince the people, the other parties there to agree with what he wanted, but that shows that he didn't force them. He didn't
right.
say if you don't do this, I'm gonna bomb you and you're gonna go down and you know. He never did things that way. He used his common sense persuasion And he was very persuasive because he always had it all worked out in his mind, and nobody could hardly ever say no to him because it just, you know, it was only after they got away from him that they started thinking, well, I wish I didn't, you know, have to agree with this or something. They might have thought that, but at the time, you know, and so that's what he was doing. But they like to portray it that he was somehow so overbearing that he just...
adamant. And, that's true.
That they didn't give him a choice.
Yeah. We'll just call this the 27th, Munich, midday, April 27th of 42. The value of the Eastern territories, the construction of a gigantic network of road and rail communications, secondary importance of waterways. The Fuhrer discussed with Professor Giesler and Minister Esser the problem of the communication system for the Eastern territories. In the regions, there will have to be a very considerable extension of existing railway lines, but they must not be planned on a local basis. Rapid communication with Constantinople is just as important to us as is rapid and easy communication between Upper Silesia and the Donets Basin. I envisage through trains covering the distances at an average speed of 200 kilometers an hour, and our present rolling stock is obviously unsuitable for the purpose. Larger carriages will be required, probably double-deckers, which will give the passengers on the upper deck an opportunity of admiring the landscape. This will presumably entail the construction of a very much broader gauge permanent way than that at present in use, and the number of lines must be doubled in order to be able to cope with any intensification of traffic. Two of these auxiliary lines in each direction will be reserved for goods traffic. We must plan on a large scale from the beginning, and I envisage for our principal line of communication, that to the Donets Basin, a four-line system. This alone will enable us to realize our plans for the exploitation of the Eastern territories. I need not say that in the execution of this vast plan, we shall meet with many difficulties, but we must not let them discourage us. All the talk about the development of an inland waterway is, in my opinion, just nonsense. In the East, there are 7 months of winter in the year, and the construction of any inland waterway of practical value is out of the question.
Okay.
Berghoff, 30th April 1942 at dinner. German tenors, a policy for our operas. The horror of Bruno Walter and Knappersbusch. Furtwängler, the only real conductor.
Ray, since he's at the Berghoff on the 30th, it makes sense that he would have, but it doesn't mean that, but it would make sense that he was in Munich on the 29th and then he went to the Berghoff.
Yes.
Doesn't mean, because sometimes he went there directly from Berlin too. Anyway, that just occurred to me.
I'm very sorry that Germany at the moment possesses only two really first-class tenors, for these two unfortunates are forced to tear round and round the country, singing in town after town, with neither rest nor respite. The fault lies with the directors of the operas and the conductors, who are not at sufficient pains to seek and recruit new talent. As a result of this lack of interest, newcomers are forced to appear solely in the provinces, and the more talent they possess, the more extended becomes their repertoire. This is a pity, for no young singer, however talented, can undertake a diversity of roles without harming his voice. Far from being able to develop their talent and improve their voices, they overstrain and ruin them prematurely. These considerations have caused me to order the director of the Munich Opera to select and train, in a rational way, a troupe of artistes designed for the future opera of Linz. I have directed him to proceed with the utmost care and to take as much time, 2 to 5 years if necessary, as he thinks fit. I have chosen this method because I think it will permit talented artistes to develop their gifts to their maximum instead of having to seek their livelihood singing any old thing, any old where. During their period of training, I will gladly pay allowances to the selected Archis, and I think it money well spent if, at the end, I'm given a company of Archis worthy of the roles they are destined to play. I hope that the directors of other operas will follow this example, and that we shall have at our disposal in a few years' time the Archis of whom the German stage has need. In this connection, I would emphasize that the mere possession of a good voice is not enough. These artistes must be taught to act and must be, men and women alike, of good appearance. The eye must also participate in the pleasures of the opera. Otherwise, one might as well not play the piece at all, but just let the artistes sing their parts. Above all, the meretricious system of inviting guest artistes for particular performances must cease. Why sacrifice regular artistes instead of giving them an opportunity of showing their talent? The right policy is to encourage those artistes who are accredited to the theater, and then to hold on at all costs to those who show more than average ability, and make it worth their while to refrain from going to Berlin or elsewhere, where all they will get will be a job as an understudy. Great conductors are as important as great singers. Had there been a sufficiency of good conductors during the time of the Weimar Republic, we should have been saved the ridiculous spectacle of the rise to eminence of a man like Bruno Walter, who in Vienna was regarded as a complete non-entity. It was the Jewish press of Munich, which was echoed by its Viennese counterpart, that drew attention to the man and suddenly proclaimed him to be the greatest conductor in Germany. But
yeah,
the last laugh was the last laugh was against Vienna, for when he was engaged as a conductor of the superb Viennese orchestra, all he could produce was beer hall music. He was dismissed, of course, and with his dismissal, Vienna began to realize what a dearth there was of good conductors, and sent for Knappersbusch. He, with his blonde hair and blue eyes, was certainly a German, but unfortunately he believed that even with no ear, he could, with his temperament, still produce good music. To attend the opera when he was conducting was a real penance. The orchestra played too loud, the violins were blanketed by the brass, and the voices of the singers were stifled. Instead of melody, one was treated to a series of intermittent shrieks, and the wretched soloists looked just like a lot of tadpoles. The conductor himself indulged in such an extravaganza of gesture that it was better to avoid looking at him at all. The only conductor whose gestures do not appear ridiculous is Furtwängler. His movements are inspired from the depths of his being. In spite of the very meager financial support he received, he succeeded in turning the Berlin Philharmonic Orchestra into an ensemble far superior to that of Vienna, and that is greatly to his credit. Some people attribute this superiority to the fact that Berlin possesses a number of genuine Stradivarius, but this explanation must be accepted with reserve. The truth is, and this, to my mind, is much more important, that Berlin enjoys the services of two quite exceptional soloists. One is 23 years old, and the second is only 19. When one succumbs to the charm of their crystal clear execution, one realizes that the bow of a 20-year-old is bound to have more lightness than that of an old violinist of 60. With the intention of finding a man of outstanding ability to become the director of music of the future at Linz, I have instructed Clemens Krauss to seek out and train a musician who will prove worthy of this honor. That's an interesting and nice little section there, and to me, the importance of it, you know, he's got a world war going on around him, and he's got so many worries about the Eastern Front and supplies and things like this, and yet he takes the time to discuss high culture and how things are going to be after the war, how they're going to be treated to the benefit of all, and artistic talent and what it takes to succeed. And the fact that a mind like that can go to those places and put other things aside is a, you know, it just astounds me. It every time I read something like that section right there, it just makes me appreciate his qualities even more.
Well, yes, you know, Ray, he did this in order to distract himself from the from the burdens of thinking about the war. And I read some places where he said that he spent 12 hours a day or something thinking about the war and working on it and so on. And then he needs to take some time and take his mind away from it in order to refresh his mind. And he would do things on purpose like that. So like at lunchtime, if he'd been working on the war all day from, and then at lunchtime he's chatting about things, you know, he'll just chat. He'll do that on purpose, try to forget about the other so that he can refresh his mind so that when he got back to it, he would, you know, he wasn't still just chewing on the same problem, you know, without any result, but he would have a new, a fresher outlook. And this is why they would call in Geisler from this point on, at times where they would work on the plans for Linz together, because he really liked doing that, and it was very invigorating for him. Instead of being an extra work that went on when he had all these worries about the war and talking to generals and so on, it was they said it did him good, you know, to get his mind off of it for periods of time and so on. And so this was his favorite thing. It was always about art, architecture. That's why he liked having Geisler come. Architecture, art, whatever, music. This is what he liked to think about. He also had said during those last years of the war that that he just regretted that he had to spend all this time working on a damn war when he really wanted to be working on the building of the cities and so on.
That's exactly right.
Yeah.
You know, a good while back in our readings, and I mean a long time back, Carolyn, he made mention when I still remember what he said about if there was just somebody available with his own ability that could take over and run this stuff, how happy he would be to just go back to art, to take off somewhere else. And that's exactly right.
Yeah. You know, He realized that he was special and that he had ability for that nobody else had, and so that's why he was doing it, and he kept on doing it. But he was planning his retirement for after the war, you know.
Right.
He would still be there to look after things and help, you know, help the new Führer and so on. But he wanted to find another one. And he had this idea how he was going to live and so on. Well, anyway, this Bruno Walter that he disliked so much was a Jew who had been in the musical world there. But after 1933, he fell out of favor with the National Socialists, and he went to Austria, which still wasn't, you know, National Socialist then. And he stayed there for a while, and then in 1939 he went to the United States. But he was just acclaimed by the press, as Hitler calls it, Jewish press of Munich and so on.
Yes.
And you know, they thought he was wonderful. In the United States, he had a big career. I don't know. I wouldn't know if I listened to him. Maybe I couldn't tell. But Hitler had such a fine sense of good music and had a great ear himself, so he didn't think much of it. And then this Nappert's Bush, he didn't had a good reputation, not great, but Hitler thought he was pretty bad. So he was comparing him to Furtwängler, who was of course so great. So that's what Hitler wanted. He wanted the best. He didn't want these mediocre ones. If he could help it, you know.
Sure. Now it returns to the Berghof, 1st of May, 1942, midday. Architectural problems. Our architects must plan on a grand scale. Bayreuth, Weimar, Dresden, the humanities in these towns, development of cultural life. I'm very grateful to Professor Giesler for having so successfully transformed the Schloss Klesheim, which is to be our guest house for distinguished visitors, and which was opened in its new role by a visit from the Duce. The general layout, which corresponds so closely to my own ideas of spaciousness, pleases me particularly. There's nothing niggardly or trashy, such as one sees in the houses of some of the minor potentates. Schloss Klesheim is the guest house of a great nation. Giesler has planned on a grand scale. He has succeeded in leaving vast spaces between the portals and the staircase, and between the staircase and the entrance to the reception halls. A sense of spaciousness is important, and I'm delighted to see our architects planning on broad and spacious lines. Only thus shall we avoid the springing up of more towns in which the houses are cluttered up almost on top of each other, as one sees in Zwickau, Gelsenkirchen, and so on. If I were banished to a town of this kind, devoid of all beauty, I should lose heart and happiness just as surely as if I've been banished from my fatherland. I am therefore determined that some measure of culture and beauty shall penetrate even into the humblest of our towns, and that, step by step, the amenities of all our towns will reach a higher level. There's a lot of truth in the assertion that the culture of a town is dependent upon its traditions. Bayreuth, Weimar, and Dresden afford classic examples. It may well be that it is impossible for any city to achieve an appearance which is pleasing to our sense of culture unless at some time or other some great man has breathed his inspiration into its walls. But we must at least see to it that from the ranks of our party plenipotentiaries, even the smallest little hamlet is given a worthy bearer, not only of the torch of National Socialist supremacy, but also of his cultural way of life. If it is not always possible to find the right man in the person of every Christlighter, then with the help of the party and its organization, we must ensure at least that the Christlighter becomes the central point of a measure of civilized amenity. Once this is accomplished, the way is open for a further progress along the path of civilization and culture. It is not sufficient that a town should have a museum which the students occasionally visit. Our representative must see to it that the men of the labor service and the Wehrmacht find it worthy of visit, and that gradually in this way the interest in and the appreciation of art will be aroused throughout the masses of the nation. The eye of the children must be weaned from the niggardly and trained on the grandiose, for only thus will they learn to appreciate both the ensemble and the finer points of any work of art. Very nice section right there, and once again, the value he places on what you were talking about a bit ago, Carolyn, with that art, because, you know, he says a museum shouldn't just attract students to go visit it once in a while, but he's talking about men in the labor service, the working guy, and then the military people should look forward to go visiting a museum. And what he's trying to do there is raise the level of awareness of the people to culture, to high culture.
Yeah, well, you know, I think also it fits in so seamlessly because he saw Germany as a great nation. It was going to be a really great nation you know, if things went his way. And then the people had to be a great people. And he didn't see that anybody could be great, a nation or people, if they were ignorant, if they had no culture, and if they were ignorant of the arts and all of that. So that all fit together for him. And so that's why he made it so important.
And when you think about the ancient civilizations of Greece, of Rome, you think about the architecture, you think about the arts, the statues, the building, you know, and he had seen how valuable that was in the many years past, and this was how far-seeing he was. What set him off from so many leaders was his ability to see down to the road, to look into the distant future, not just to today and tomorrow, but on down the line. And this trying to raise the level of art appreciation among the people was one of his goals, and I think it was an extremely worthy effort.
Yes. Again, you know, too bad that got stopped. Everything. Just, I hate to think about it. You know, that thing you sent me to yesterday, was it? I looked through it about the theft of all the technology, the German technology. And, well, it goes into some very interesting detail. But, you know, I find that I haven't been able to settle down and really read it carefully yet because that depresses me so much. You know, I used to be able to handle things like that, but I think I think I'm getting older makes me more sensitive and less able to handle unpleasant things, and I find that extremely depressing. Maybe I need a sunny day to read it, but to be confronted with that terrible things that happened, well, how terrible it was. Just makes me almost ill. So, well, anyway, we've got a timeline here for the first that I passed by, but I'll read the first and the second. For the Rommel readies for a new offensive during the early part of this month. It's not really just for the first. And then back to Japan, the troops of the Japanese 15th Army under General Soichiro Aida take Mandalay and Maniwa, securing the western terminus of the Burma Road. And then, for the second and third, we have second, in response to American intelligence intercepts which warn of the impending Japanese landings, the Australian garrison is evacuated from Tulagi. And on the third, in the initial move of the Japanese strategic plan to capture Port Moresby, Japanese forces under Admiral Shima make unopposed landings on Tulagi, opening the Battle of the Coral Sea. And something about an American General Joseph Stilwell, I've heard of him, decides that nothing more can be accomplished in Burma and that the time has come to evacuate. So the Japanese are still in control.
Oh, yeah.
Although the other Americans aren't giving up. But Stilwell, later on, he has to go on this trek trying to get to India to escape because they were kind of trapped there.
That's right.
In Burma, yeah.
Okay, we'll move on to the 3rd of May, 1942, midday. The Burgerbrau plot. A Swiss tries his hand at assassination. Measures against assassins. Some unavoidable risks. In the two really dangerous attempts made to assassinate me, I owe my life not to the police, but to pure chance. On the 9th of November, 1939, I left the Burgerbrau 10 minutes before the appointed time because of an urgent conference in Berlin, which it was imperative that I should attend. In the other attempt, my life was saved because the would-be killer, a Swiss, who stalked me for 3 months in the neighborhood of the Berghof, regularly missed me when I went out. And when he tried to continue his stalking in Munich, he was discovered by a railway official. The man apparently had traveled beyond Munich with a ticket from Berchtesgaden to Munich, and the railway official in question asked for an explanation. The story that he had been in Berchtesgaden for several months trying to deliver a letter to me aroused the suspicions of the railway man, who caused him to be held for interrogation. When the man was searched, a sealed envelope addressed personally to me was found on him, but the envelope was empty, a circumstance which led to a full confession. The confessions of this Swiss interested me insofar as they confirmed my conviction that not a soul could cope with an assassin who, for idealistic reasons, was prepared quite ruthlessly to hazard his own life in the execution of his object. I quite understand why 90% of the historic assassinations have been successful. The only preventive measure one can take is to live irregularly, to walk, to drive, and to travel at irregular times and unexpectedly. But that, after all, is merely normal caution and not prevention. As far as is possible, whenever I go anywhere by car, I go off unexpectedly and without warning the police. I also have given Rattenhuber, the commander of my personal security squad, and Kempka, my chauffeur, the strictest orders to maintain absolute secrecy about my comings and goings, and have further impressed on them that this order must still be obeyed even when the highest officials in the land make inquiries. As soon as the police get to hear that I'm going somewhere, they abandon all normal procedure and adopt emergency measures, which, to say the least of it, are most alarming to normal people, and yet they never seem to realize that it is just these emergency antics which are conspicuous and draw attention where no attention is desired. I had a splendid example of this sort of thing when, at the time of the Anschluss, I went to Vienna and Pressburg. The police raised the alarm along the whole route, both from Vienna to Nikolsburg and on to Pressburg, an action which was all the more dangerous because they simply did not have the necessary forces at their disposal to guard the roads. Apart from this, the Gestapo plainclothesmen dressed themselves in such an astonishing collection of clothes, rough woolen Macintosh coats, Osler's capes, and so forth, that I, and indeed any moron, could recognize them for what they were at a glance. When I gave orders that we were to follow a route other than the one agreed upon and were to stop like any other citizen at the traffic lights in the villages, I was able to continue my journey unnoticed and unmolested. Police protection is of great importance only on those occasions when the date, time, and place have been precisely fixed. Even on these occasions, the activities of the police have a disturbing effect, cause crowds to collect, and lead to endless difficulties. These things, however, must be accepted with good grace on occasions like the 1st of May, the 9th of November, the Harvest Festival of Buchenberg, where several hundred thousand people, 700,000 people, foregather, and my own birthday. In the midst of such crowds, it is easy for some fanatic armed with a telescopic sighted firearm to take a shot at me from some corner or other. Any likely hole or corner, therefore, must be kept under careful observation. During the hours of darkness, police searchlights must be so sighted that their rays light up these danger spots and are not, as happened to me in Hamburg, concentrated all the time on my own car. Narrow streets should, as far as possible, be avoided on official occasions. The 5-meter-wide lane leading to the Kroll Opera in Berlin, for example, is potentially one of the most dangerous bits of road I know. As there can never be absolute security against fanatics and idealists on official occasions, I always make a point of standing quietly upright in my car. And this method has again and again proved the truth of the proverb that the world belongs to the brave. If some fanatic wishes to shoot me or kill me with a bomb, I am no safer sitting down than standing up. And in any case, the number of fanatics who seek my life on idealistic grounds is getting much smaller. Among the bourgeoisie and the Marxists, it would be hard to find a would-be assassin ready to risk his own life if necessary. The only really dangerous elements are either those fanatics who have been goaded to action by dastardly priests, or nationalistically minded patriots from one of the countries we have occupied. And my many years of experience make things fairly difficult, even for such as these. When I'm traveling by night in my car, for instance, I do not think it is any longer possible for any one of us, anyone following us in another car, to take a shot at either myself or my chauffeur from the apparently easy position when we are rounding a bend, because having learned a lesson from the Rathenau plot, I have now installed a searchlight in the back of the car, which allows me to blind the driver of any following car at will. So an interesting little bit there.
Well, I think so. You know, now here again, he's really using his common sense, and he's put thought into all of this. His mind is probably working all the time. He's always thinking about things. And so, you know, he's... And he remembers it, too. He had a good memory still. I've lost my memory, but So he remembers what he thinks about and he can talk about it. It all makes so much sense what he's saying. And, you know, people foolishly want to have a whole bunch of protection when it just draws attention, as he said. And is it here that he said if you do something at different times of the day? Oh, yeah, I've got my note here. He said this Swiss person who was trying to kill him,
yes,
but he got caught. He was looking to see, you know, when he left the house and so on. But he said he always left it at a different time, so the guy never could was there when he left. But this is, he says that the only preventive measure one can take is to live irregularly. Well, then I thought of poor Heydrich and how foolish he was to be so punctual all the time and drive through the city of Prague at the exact same time every day in his open car.
Yeah.
And you know, I was thinking about how Heydrich said, well, you know, the Czech people won't hurt me. And he sort of wanted to prove that he could drive around in Prague. You know, Heydrich said to his wife said after he died that he was very happy to get this job as a Reich's protector of Bohemia, Moravia. Because he was tired of being the worst man in the National Socialist Party. He was tired of being known as the killer, as the monster. And he knew he was, you know, the top policeman and so on who was behind all this bad stuff, supposedly. And he didn't like that, but he did it because that was the job they gave him and he was good at it. But he was good at everything. But he had won over the Czech people and he was real proud of that. And this was a different kind of a thing he was doing now. And so I think he just enjoyed showing that he could drive through Prague in an open car and he didn't have to be afraid of the people. And it wasn't the people who harmed him, but
right,
it was these English, assassins that the English had trained. But the fact was that he went at the same time every day. He was so orderly and punctual, see. And so
sure,
they knew. And and Himmler was, here again, where they another thing where they try to talk to people, but they don't force them. Both Hitler didn't like that, and Himmler for sure was telling him not to do that, not to drive, you know, to drive in a closed car, and he wouldn't do it, and he lost his life, which was a tragedy for everybody. So, except maybe the enemies, but anyway, I'm sure they were happy about it. But it was, and Hitler put his thoughts into this. Hitler knew that it wasn't just his love for his own life. Well, everybody has that naturally, but he knew how important he was to what was going on and to Germany. So he tried to take precautions and not get killed. And you have to admire him for that. He was putting, once again, he was putting the German people and so on ahead of anything that he was, you know, worrying about for himself. He was thinking about what was good for Germany.
Right.
So I really appreciate all this part that you just read for that.
Well,
reason.
I really appreciate your comments there and enlightenment on Reinhard Heydrich, because he has always been, I guess I could say, one of my favorites as far as a National Socialist. He embodied so much of what National Socialism stood for. And I think, you know, when he got killed, it was a tremendous loss, you know. So I appreciate your telling the information there on him.
Yeah, well, it was, and everybody knew it, too. They all knew what a loss it was. They had big plans for him. It was horrible. So, okay, well, that's the kind of thing you have to face.
Yep.
So I guess, we're about done here, and this is a long section, so maybe
it's a long section. It's about 5 pages.
Well, you know, why don't we just stop here? We don't have to go. You know, it's I think it'd be best. So you have any? We could always talk a little more about anything that came up here, and a little more about Reinhard Heydrich or anything like that in the time that we have. If there's anything that comes to your mind.
You know, well, I'll tell you what, let's go back to that, what you mentioned a while ago about the article I sent you, so that anyone listening will know what we're talking about. And that had been sent to me by someone who is interested in the same things that we are. And it was about the end of the war and how Germany was ravaged by the Americans and by the Russians, and not only for their equipment and advanced airplanes and rockets and things like this, but their people, their scientists, and how America and Russia rushed in and grabbed what they could. And the Russians, really, they transported whole factories back to Russia.
And I knew that that was the case, but, you know, you have to read it in more detail to really
yes.
get the feeling of it. And in this thing, when it said it, in this thing that you sent me, which I just brought up here, called, it's titled Russian Jets. I don't know if that's the real title of it. But that they took, and it describes what was in these factories and all the work that the Germans had done and had not even been able to make use of yet. And it all went to
right.
the Soviet Union.
Yeah, and part of it to the USA. And this, there were a couple of interesting things in the article. One was, and I wish I could remember his name right now. You'll see it when you read it over. But brilliant
Go
scientist offered his services to the American side and was rebuffed. Like, we don't have anything that we can use.
Heinz, he had no
alternative. He just went to the Russians, you know, to stay alive and to feed his family. And, you know, and he was very valuable for the Russians because I think he was the fellow that came up with the idea of the jets. It would be very advantageous if they had the swept wings, you know, wings that angled back, and helped develop the MiG fighter for Russia. And that's why initially when the MiG came out and was used in the Korean War, the American F-86s was still the straight wings that you see on propeller planes back then, and at a disadvantage because the MiG with the swept wing was much, much more adept and fast and maneuverable than our fighters until we started building our jets with swept wings. And things like this and the technology that for guided missiles, for rockets and things like this that Germany was working on. And I think I wrote a note on that it's just really hurtful that these things weren't developed a year or two sooner, that Germany didn't have them available, because it certainly could have made a great difference in that nation being crushed to smithereens. You know, Germany, if they had been able to develop such fighters earlier, a year or two earlier than they did, it could have turned the tide.
And you know, people criticize Hitler for hanging on and not surrendering, as though there was any way that he could have surrendered except unconditionally from 1943
right.
on. You know, and even before that, he tried to work out deals, and they wouldn't do it. So they never did want to work out anything with Germany. But that they criticized. Oh, he killed all these soldiers. He kept the fight going. He destroyed all of Germany. Well, you know, he knew what was in the works. He knew all this great stuff was being worked on, and he was kept hoping that something would get ready in time. You know, for him, and up to the very end, he was hoping that. That one general would be able to come and save Berlin or something, you know, or protect Berlin.
Yeah.
He was never able to get his troops up there. But, you know, that was the reason. He knew. And you're right. It just was too late. There wasn't enough time. It's so tragic in my mind. You know, we look at the world today. It's an unbelievable tragedy.
Well, Germany put out feelers in 1943. One of their efforts went twice through the Vatican to have the Vatican contact the American government and the British, saying that call off this war on the Western front here. Instead of fighting each other, I'll tell you what, we'll back off and just go back into German territory and call a truce with you guys, and let us finish this war with the Soviets. And,
stop
the war now, and we're willing to do this. Let us go on and turn our full attention to fighting the communists. And they were totally rebuffed. And
they didn't want to fight the communists until afterwards. Then they decided they had to fight the communists. Well,
what that goes back to, Carolyn, is the money system that Germany came up with under National Socialism to seize control of its own money, to print its own money, to loan it to get government work done, projects done, roads built, everything like this, without paying interest. And boy, it lifted Germany, as you know, any student knows of this subject, that out of that Great Depression, which was much worse than ours here in the United States. And so they could not have Germany survive because of that example of what happens when you get away from the debt-based money system of the worldwide usurers that have control of everything now. That was why Germany had to be totally crushed.
Well, okay, and we're going to, I guess we'll sign off now, all right? So.
Okay.
Thank
everybody for joining us tonight, and we look forward to next week, which will be, if I'm right, the 13th?
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. And, folks, we appreciate it, and we will see you next week.
Okay. Good night for now.